Econ Connect. Mensch, Potenzial, Technologie.
For over 15 years, he has worked for the biggest search engine on this planet, in Silicon Valley and in Switzerland. As a powerhouse for database management, he actively transformed the efficiency of work processes for global companies. He also was responsible for major projects such as YouTube, the largest video streaming platform in the world, to make it run smoothly. Now Stephen Wheeler brings technology to small and medium-sized businesses and saves time for them and increases the productivity and efficiency. Stephen Wheeler, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen, you worked for many years for the biggest search engine for Google. So I just wanted to ask you a question. What was it like working for Google? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the culture of Google.
Yes, absolutely. For me, I think Google was almost a perfect place to work in many regards. My specific job description there, I was a user experience researcher. And what that entails is using research projects, I would gather information and insights about how people like to use products and then feed the information back to product teams to improve the product design. And I'd done that in a number of different Silicon Valley companies before I joined Google. But at Google, things were just a little bit better than anywhere I'd been before. There were really fabulous tools that we could use. There was a focus on excellence in business practices. And the products that we were using, or we were researching, were just interesting anyway. So I worked in my time there. I worked on really two product classes, if you like. The first one was Google Maps. And then I concentrated on working on YouTube. And those are just interesting products. They're used by literally millions, if not billions, of people across the planet. So that you know that when you're doing your work for projects and project teams within Google, you are affecting the experiences of a huge number of people. And that gives you a certain amount of responsibility, but it's just exciting to do that. And I loved it. I really had a good time there. I met some excellent colleagues, and I'm still in touch with lots of people from Google and from YouTube. And then at YouTube, I concentrated on various different parts of the industry, of the business. You can roughly divide it between the experiences of people who watch, who consume the video content, and those who make the video content. And I think I divided my time roughly 50-50 between those two, starting with the viewer side and then finishing, when I moved to Zurich here, on the creator side.
So, Stephen, what would you say was the skill set that you learned at Google and on all these projects? What did you learn, but also in engaging with colleagues? Is there anything particular that stands out?
Yes, lots of things stand out, really. I think just because there's such a focus on excellence at Google, I think there was pressure both externally but also, you know, internally from myself to do the best work that I possibly could and to improve my practices and my knowledge of the methods that I was applying. And I grew as a professional a great deal when I was there. I think I was fairly well-rounded when I joined Google, and that's why they hired me, because we'll probably come onto this, but they do hire people who are, they look for good talent, and I hope that I fitted that description. But I didn't realize when I started that I had a lot to learn. And so over the course of the 10 years or so I was working there, I really improved my practice, my skills, and I became very interested in the methodological approaches that one needed to bring to bear when we are doing projects. And not only did I did I improve my practices, but I also learned a whole lot of other things that I needed for my job. And I've come away with those, and in some ways, those some of the things that I've learned have become more interesting to me than the original skills I had when I joined.
And how would you say that this culture was actively promoted by the company, this culture of excellence?
Yes. I mean, it starts with hiring. It's a very complicated hiring process. There are several rounds of interviews. You have to make presentations. You get the feeling straight away that you're being assessed for your abilities and your talents. And it's quite a difficult experience, actually. And then when I joined Google, again, on the hiring side, they have something called the hiring committee, and you become qualified to become an interviewer for talent externally for the hiring. And I probably did something like, over the course of the years I was there, probably something like 200 interviews of external candidates. And even that process was refined and scrutinized to the nth degree, so that Google was confident that it was hiring the right people. And so we just had a very high quality of colleagues that were working there, some very, very talented people. And that just brings out a sense of motivation within you to bring the best of your abilities to your project, to learn from people, but also as you become more experienced in your job, to help others, to mentor people, to give people advice, especially junior colleagues. And that's something I also really became to enjoy. So everywhere within Google, it felt that there was a focus on excellence. It just wasn't good enough to do something that was just good enough, if you know what I mean. You really had to be aware that you were expected to do your best, and that sounds like there's a certain amount of pressure there, and there was, but it's actually that's a positive pressure. Through that process, I became a better researcher. I learned more things, and I made some extremely good relationships with people I'm still in touch with.
And can you tell me something a little bit more in detail about the recruiting process? You said it's a lengthy process. It's a very diligent process. Yeah. Is there anything peculiar about it, or any particular questions that you ask the potential new candidates? So maybe you can tell our viewers a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, yes. So I mentioned earlier that I was interested in methodology because... as a researcher, my background is in science, and there do need to be some principles, some methodological principles that you apply when you're doing research projects of whatever type. And I think for my personal focus when I was interviewing people was to try to get from the candidates a sense of what their methodological understanding was, because it mattered whether people knew about the methods that they would be applying in their research projects, from which they would be delivering insights that could have an effect on the design of a product. And so for me, it was very important to understand whether the candidate knew about the subject we were basically recruiting them for. And so my personal questions in interviews were based around that. And I had a number of questions that I suppose they were, some of them could be perceived as trick questions, but I certainly, most of the candidates would actually struggle to give me a good answer.
Can you use an example?
Yes, certainly, actually. So one is to do with small sample observations. So we would do studies of designs, and for various reasons, we would be constrained into having perhaps 5 or 6 participants in a study who would run through a facet of a user experience or a piece of design, and we would make observations about where the design was either succeeding or failing. And so these would be called insights, or you'd be looking for usability problems, so design flaws, and hoping to fix them. This is just one example, by the way. And my question would focus on how many. So if a typical study, first of all, I would ask people how many would they recruit for a typical study, and the answer would be usually 5 or 6 or 7 people, and that's done because simply you haven't got enough time in a week or something like that, the duration of the project. To recruit more people. And it turns out that after 3 or 4 or 5 people, you will start to see the same patterns of problems. And so really you've almost exhausted the possibility of, within that reasonable time frame, of finding any more problems. So my question would focus on how many of the recruiting cohort that you had made, how many of those people does it take for you to make a valid observation? Now, my belief is that the answer is 1, because if somebody was reasonably recruited and they were doing something normal and they can give a good explanation as to why they did that thing, then you've actually given a good explanation as to why something is a problem and how it can be fixed. And for me, that's a good enough answer. But people would go into these convoluted discussions about statistics, which have nothing to do with a small sample study of that type, and if they hadn't thought about that, then sometimes that was enough for me to know that they really weren't thinking carefully about the approach they should be taking. That was just one example of a question. For most other cases, what would happen would be that a candidate would present a portfolio or examples of projects they'd worked on, and we would, as an interviewing panel, we'd focus on parts of that and ask them about what they'd done. The other thing about the recruiting was there was always one recruiter who was in charge of looking for the candidate, and that person would look after the candidate all the way through the whole process. They would also be in touch with us, and so we'd know exactly when the interview was happening, who else was on the panel, when our feedback was expected, and then at the end of the whole process, we would get feedback collectively about the candidate and whether they'd been accepted or rejected and why. And we also had a very, very comprehensive website where you could look at the notes that other people had submitted, and as a justification for why they were saying a higher or no higher or leaning towards higher recommendation. And so all of that was done very, very well. And the other thing was that we were given specific roles. They used to call them interview hats. And so we would focus on different specialities. So one was to do with, I can't remember what they were called now, but things like sort of domain knowledge or previous experience or something like that. And so we would not end up just asking the same question of the candidate over and over again. And we even had sample questions that we could draw from. So these had been drawn up by an interview panel, which was a large number of Google employees over a period of many years. And so there were these standard questions that people could ask. So you didn't have to think about how to create your interview protocol every time. I did have one for myself because for each of these interview roles, there were specific things that I wanted to ask and liked to focus on. But if I was given an interview hat that wasn't the usual one, then I could just go to the resource and pick from the suggested questions that they had. So the whole thing was really professional, very efficient, and there were always ways of improving it, and they'd look for those. But certainly towards the end of my career there, that was something I could rely on as being a very good resource for interviewing people and being confident that we as a collective panel had recruited the right people.
Okay, so there was a very minor risk of hiring than the wrong candidate because you did your due diligence well enough, and it was a very thorough process.
Certainly a reduced risk. Yeah.
Excellent. Sounds very interesting. I want to dig a little bit more deeper into the retaining of talent. Now, has it ever occurred, for example, that people, I'm sure there were many employees that received also offers from other companies, especially in Silicon Valley. I assume there's a high competition also among the tech companies that people stayed at Google as a result of the culture. So did you actively seek to, or how did you actively seek to promote a culture where to retain talent and keep employees? So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, certainly in the first years there, the first sort of 7 or 8 years of my tenure at Google, it was very highly regarded within Silicon Valley as being one of the best places to work. And there were a variety of websites where companies were being compared, and Google always used to come out pretty much on top as a very good place to work in terms of benefits, company culture, the quality of your colleagues, the type of work that you did, and all these different criteria. It always used to come out top. I think things have changed in the last couple of years in Silicon Valley generally. Unfortunately, there have been in the last couple of years a lot of layoffs, so things have changed a little bit. But in terms of employee retention, it was very high. People felt they were well rewarded and the benefits were good. So that was one thing that definitely kept people there. But for me, that stuff didn't really matter so much. I was honestly more motivated by the fact that the work was interesting and I could enjoy myself and feel that I was doing my best work. And the benefits and the the salary and that was very nice as well. But for me, that was kind of secondary stuff. And also back then, I think people were attracted, certainly from the rumors in the early 2000s of the amazing facilities that Google had and the food. There was free food in Silicon Valley, and that did attract people on a superficial basis. And in the really early days, actually, when the company was sort of in the low thousands of people, there was one example where people, I think, were given a cash bonus of $1,000, literally cash. And so they're going home with their pockets stuffed with, $100 bills. It seems a bit risky now. But that sort of thing, the rumor would go around Silicon Valley of how great it was to work at Google. And that persisted for a long time. Of course, as the company got bigger, they couldn't possibly do that sort of thing, but still the benefits were very good. And so for me, that's what kept me there. It sounds like I'm contradicting myself. There were nice benefits, but for me, it was really the culture, the work that was what kept me motivated, to be honest with you. And we had lovely offices, very comfortable surroundings, and there were games rooms and all sorts of interesting, colourful things to do and see. But, those things became very minor attractions towards the end because we were just there to do work. And so the work should have been the first thing to keep you motivated, and usually was. And I was still working at Google when we had the shutdown, so I didn't go to the office for a number of years. And I didn't feel that it was much of a difference in terms of motivation, even though I wasn't going to this lovely office with all the facilities and the ping pong tables and the food. I still had the same interest in working with my colleagues and doing good things or mm-hmm. trying to work on interesting things. So that's what kept me going anyway.
Okay. And now you told me that you have a passion because you also helped to develop the Google Drive, the spreadsheet that I'm also using myself for my business. And it helped me a lot to increase the efficiency of my business. It's very practical. And maybe you can also tell me more about your passion that you have about these tools, these spreadsheet tools, and so how did you get into it?
Yeah, this is interesting because it's sort of a byproduct of my primary job role, and I think it came about because as a researcher, I had to do a lot of good infrastructure that I could rely on to do my job efficiently and not have to reinvent the wheel every time, or just to find ways to be more efficient. And we used a lot of tools in our job to support the research projects that we did. And some of them were maybe less efficient than you would like, and you would find that there'd be common inefficiencies that everybody would encounter. And I became interested in finding solutions to those things as almost like a secondary thing to my job. And it almost became the case in which I was more interested in doing the work on efficiency and building the infrastructure than I was in doing the research projects that those things were supporting. And I really enjoyed not only building little tools or working out how to identify resources that could help you become more efficient, but I also enjoyed sharing those with other people, because we were all experiencing the same types of inefficiencies or challenges in our jobs. And so building tools or helping to construct tools where people could be more efficient became something I just liked. And in many cases, those were things that everybody had access to but just didn't know the capabilities of. And spreadsheets is one example of many. I think that came about, I'll tell you how it did come about. I was working on a survey tool that was collecting hundreds of thousands of responses on a monthly basis. And it was a very simple survey that had effectively two questions. One was a 5-point scale asking people how satisfied or dissatisfied they were with a product. And then the second question was called an open-ended question, in which people optionally could write in why they had given that answer. And it turned out in a survey like that that the real insight was not in the first question, but the second. In fact, the answers for the first question, if you averaged them out month on month, they didn't change much. It was almost constant, but sometimes you would derive these little insights from what people wrote. But doing the analysis of that was incredibly arduous because you have to read thousands and thousands of responses. And so this is where my spreadsheet thing came in, because I developed ways of categorizing responses into, well, response categories, which would fluctuate in their frequency month on month, or sometimes a new category would emerge that would reveal that something had changed in a product. And you couldn't get that insight from a 5-point scale that asks you how satisfied you are, but you do from the open-ended response. Other surveys were more complicated than that, but that type of requirement generated a need to use spreadsheets very effectively so that you could categorize and look at frequencies and then report on that. And then it just grew from there. And from that, I would learn new methods or tools just to make the spreadsheet more effectively, ways of hooking them up, connecting them with Google Drive. And then once you've discovered things like that, then so many other possibilities just open themselves up to you. So that's really how it came about. It's not just the spreadsheets, but also survey tools and statistical analysis, which I also used to do through spreadsheets as well. That was an interesting example too, because a lot of people used to use these dedicated statistics packages. There was one called R, for example, letter R, and it's very difficult to use. Most of my research colleagues had no idea how to use it. And so people were intimidated by this stuff. But what they didn't realize was they didn't need to use these vastly sophisticated tools. They could just use spreadsheets and get the same insights if they knew what they were doing, and if they had the right type of program, if you like, or formulae within the spreadsheet to be able to plug their numbers into and then get an answer out at the other end, to put it very simply. But you have to build that, and that's the sort of thing I used to enjoy doing.
So how can a small and medium-sized business owner increase the efficiency of the business and productivity and make more money by using these tools?
Well, I think everyone has, I think that this is the thing, I think everybody has access to basic tools. Well, they're not very basic, but if you think of an office suite, so you have your, you know, typically there's going to be something like, well, for Google, there was Google Drive, which is a file storage system. I don't know the equivalents in Microsoft, but there are things like Exchange Server. But there's the whole office suite within Microsoft, Excel, Word, and then the slides, PowerPoint. Google has an equivalent set. So the file management system there is called Google Drive, and there's Calendar, Gmail. They're all connected. And then, of course, the tools are Google Slides for your slides presentations, and then Google Spreadsheets and Docs for written documents. But they're all really beautifully connected. And a lot of people just don't know the capabilities of them. And especially with Sheets, I think Sheets is a very useful tool. So whenever numbers and figures get involved, everyone just goes to a spreadsheet. It's just what people do now. But when I see people using spreadsheets now, it's really remarkable how little how readily apparent it is how people haven't unlocked the capabilities of the sheets, what they can do to make them efficient in so many ways. So I see that almost every time a spreadsheet is used, I see that. And it's not to be critical of people. I think you have to be a little bit insightful to realize there's a possibility to open up these capabilities. For example, there are Reddit forums where people ask questions about how to use Google Sheets, and I'm on them as a contributor to answer questions. And many people, it just reveals how little people do know, and what the opportunity there is to be more efficient and to help people. And I just enjoy that. And you know, going back to what I said earlier about sharing information with colleagues, it's just something I like to do. So that's where it comes from. So I have a technical ability which came from my own need. I'm a little bit inquisitive, so I found out how you can do things, and then I like to share the information with other people and help them become more efficient in their jobs and for their companies and organizations.
Yeah, and also helps a small, medium-sized business owner, if he doesn't want to hire extra staff, you know, he becomes more efficient in order to, get some mentoring to increase the efficiency.
Yeah.
So you don't have to hire extra staff for your business.
That's exactly it. And I think for small and medium-sized businesses, they simply can't afford to have a specialist. I have a friend of mine who does something very similar with, he worked in the City of London as a tech guy, and he did database programming, as I've done myself. His application was different from the consumer products I worked on at Google. He was working for large banks in the city, so heavily focused on numbers and reporting. And there's a heavy need for accuracy in how you report the data. There are regulatory requirements as to why that's the case. And so the equivalent there, I was talking earlier about the need for methodological validity in the way that you would approach a research project. Well, his equivalent would be absolutely making sure that the numbers are being reported correctly. Anyway, he now works for himself, and his clients are small asset managers in London, and they simply cannot afford to do this spreadsheet work for themselves. They have to have an outside person because it's everyone else is doing their asset managers. That's their job. And so, no, absolutely right. People can't afford to have these specialists, but there's a reliance on accuracy and data integrity, and so they need help with this sort of stuff. Yeah,
they need help for that.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Stephen. That was really insightful. And best of luck for your future business.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.